Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to the world's longest running football fans podcast from CelticUnderground.net.
The road is long.
I interviewed our guest today at the Houses of Parliament, and it was on the day that the Hillsborough inquest result finally determined that what we all know and all knew as football supporters, but unfortunately it took 27 years to come out, that the Liberal fans were not responsible and that many other people in positions of authority and power within this country were responsible. Not only were they responsible for people dying that day, but also were responsible for covering it up for 27 years. It's only when you're my age and you start to think back that for many people under the age of about 35, they will have no recollection of that day. Those of us over that age will remember vividly where we were as football supporters, as it was the day that we realised it could have been us. The day that we realised all those times when you thought it was fun that you were going down this flight of stairs at the back of the Celtic end at Hampden, your feet didn't touch the ground and you saw policemen hanging about, that they weren't in control. It was just luck that it wasn't us. And I think that's why the Justice for 96 campaign resonated for so long amongst so many football fans. Anyway, justice has been done and that was fantastic. So, on to our guest, Mr. Kevin Schofield, who sets out his credentials for being a Celtic supporter in the podcast. The podcast is a mixture of Celtic chat and political chat. Hopefully not too much political in terms of giving an opinion, but political nonetheless in terms of Kevin's current role, how he got to be in that role, and what it's like reporting on that, and a wee bit of insight into one or two events that are coming up in the political world, and then back onto the hoops again. So, we've got a title to win. I'm recording this on Friday night. Maybe we'll have won it by the time you're listening to it. Or maybe we won't. I do sort of think it would sum up the season if we draw at Tynecastle and then Aberdeen lose and we win by not playing. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Kevin Schofield, and podcast number 279. So I'm joined now by Kevin Schofield, the editor of politicshome.com website. So how are you doing, Kevin?
I'm very well, thank you. Working hard in the Palace of Westminster, enjoying life.
I'll get on to your politics home first. Second. But first of all, you have to say out your credentials.
Yeah.
So who was your first Celtic hero?
Yeah.
And what was your first Celtic game?
My first Celtic hero, and this is a bit of a bizarre one and I can't really explain it, was Peter Latchford.
So is mine!
Well, it's bizarre, and I can't put my finger on why, because I was born in 1974 and I didn't really start. We'll come on to my first game in a wee minute, but my first game was 81. So by which stage, Pat Bonner was pretty much first choice. But I think it was my dad used to get the, you remember the Playing for Celtic
books
used to get every year? I remember my dad having one for the 1979-80 season and won the Cup, the Old Firm final, and in the middle of it was colour pictures of the game and of the team and all that, and Peter Latchford was in a few of them, and I don't know if it was the green top that he had on or what, but I just sort of latched onto him, pardon the pun,
and
I just thought for some reason he became, and my mum and dad now can't start kidding me on about it, I became like a bit obsessed with Peter Latchford. I never wanted to be a goalkeeper, but he became kind of a bit of a cult figure almost, you know. And I think we did actually see him at one game in goals for Celtic, which was quite a big deal.
He played for Celtic, I think, in a game in 86.
Was that against Aberdeen, maybe?
I can't remember.
But he was massive.
He was massive, yeah. I mean, my recollection was
he was
enormous.
Overweight. Yeah. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
It's a bit like
that Hibs goalie.
Aye, yeah. But then, I don't know if that's your mind playing tricks, because
I saw Tommy Gemmell play as player manager for Dundee, and my recollection is, you know, when you see guys who've got a t-shirt that's too short for them and their belly hangs over. So my recollection is I could actually see Tommy Gemmell's belly. I don't think I could. So it's maybe.
So aye. So anyway, so that was Peter Latchford. But I suppose the one, and this is controversial, is that. But also, wasn't it? You know what he would end up doing to us was probably Mo Johnson. Probably. I mean, just if you think about it. When he signed 84, I was just about to turn 10.
Yeah.
So I was at that, and he was the glamorous striker, scored a lot of goals, won the league in 86, all that type of stuff, and I just thought Mo was great. Obviously, I've somewhat had to revise my opinion after 1989, but yeah, so I'll stick with Peter Latchford instead of Mo Johnson.
I've got a scarf, actually, you just reminded me, in my loft, that says Peter number one. It's got a thing across the...
Really?
Aye, I'll take a picture of it and I'll send it to
you. Oh, do that. God, why did I not have one of that? I should have.
Well, you see, I'm older than you. And it was actually my brother who got that.
Oh, I see.
It was in the days when you got patches and stuff that you stuck
that's
on.
That's right. You see boys in their badges and their patches on their scarf and on their denim jackets and stuff like that.
So if they were your heroes and your first... So when was your first game? 81,
first
you said?
First game was 81 against Aberdeen. And we drew 1-1 and... very fortuitously, it's just recently the highlights have been up on YouTube,
right.
Which I think might be St. Anthony. I think he uploads stuff onto YouTube under a different name.
Right, okay.
Perhaps.
I'll find
I think
it.
It's Ronnie Glavin is the name, and it's been uploaded by right. Ronnie Glavin. I might be getting that wrong, that it's anything to do with St. Anthony. But anyway, it went up just 2 or 3 months ago, and I had very, very faint recollections of it because I would only have been 6, maybe 7 at the time.
Right.
And we drew 1-1, and we were in the main stand because my mum's auntie used to live near Neely Mochan, and he used to get tickets for games. And obviously, me being so wee, we went to the main stand. So I went with my dad and my uncle, and we drew 1-1, and Aberdeen scored first. And I'm told, because I can't remember this, I was so thoroughly fed up and a bit bored, I kind of took my tammy off, and I sat there, and then Celtic equalised late on, and then we got a goal chalked off right at the very end, George McCluskey, offside. And the only other thing I remember is my dad explaining to me why it wasn't offside and how the referee had robbed us, and me going to school on the Monday and basically just parroting my dad, explaining to all my pals, this is why it wasn't offside. I hadn't a clue what the offside rule was or anything, but anyway, so I just parroted my dad saying we were robbed. So that was my first game, 1981, but I was a wee boy then.
And then when did you start going regularly?
My first season ticket was me and my uncle. My mum's brother, it was 1989-90. We had a season ticket in the old jungle. So you went to all the home games then, and that was like quite possibly the worst season I remember as a fan. I don't know if you remember, we finished 5th that season. That was Big Billy's 3rd season. So we'd won the cup in 89.
Yep.
And was that, did we sign? I'm trying to remember. That was Mo Johnson nearly came back. We were getting Jackanowski and Mike Galloway, I think, signed that summer. So there was reasonable optimism. And that was when Tommy Coyne scored a hat-trick in the first day of the season at Tynecastle.
Yep.
3-1, so we thought...
I can remember saying to my mates going away, we're either going to challenge Rangers this season or Hearts are going to face relegation.
Aye.
And Hearts face relegation.
Yeah, well, we didn't challenge Rangers, you're right there. Jackie got off to a flying start that season as well. We really looked apart, but it really quickly went downhill. And like I say, we finished 5th, I think. The Nadir... that season was probably the last game at Parkhead, and it was a Friday night or something, I think, against Aberdeen, and if we had to beat them to get into Europe, and they put out like a bunch of kids. Ian Jess was just a teenager at the time, a bunch of young laddies they put out, and we scored early. Andy Walker scored for 5 minutes. We thought, here we go, and we got beat 3-1. They just cleared us off the park, and it was just a miserable season. So I kept that season ticket for another couple of years, and then stopped going with my uncle and started going with my pals to the jungle every home game, pretty much. And a couple of years after that, me and my mates used to go to away games as well. So that was Liam Brady, Lou McCarry time. So I feel like I put the hours in when we were really, really bad, so you're able to enjoy it when it got good, you know.
So what's your perception of where things are just now? Because I think people who've been through that, like... in your formative teen years, started to go quite heavily when it was crap, like me. I think you sometimes have a better perspective of where we are just now.
Yeah, you do. I still think it's
you still can get frustrated and stuff.
Oh, of course you do, aye. And it's nothing near as bad as when the Kellys were there and the Whites, you know, that was when it was really, really bad and Rangers were running away with it. And before Fergus came back, it was really, really bad. So I think that does give you a bit of perspective. But it, as you say, it doesn't stop you being disappointed at the way things are now. And I just think there's been a real kind of missed opportunity.
Yeah.
With Rangers being away and we've just regressed. I mean, there was always going to be, I suppose, a bit of downsizing,
mm-hmm.
a little bit, but you know, you just look at the team now and the squad, it's really depressing, you know.
Well, we'll move on off the depressing stuff. I am sitting with you in the Palace of Westminster.
Yeah.
How did you get into politics?
Well, I kind of fell into it, really, because like probably like a lot of boys, like football fans, I wanted to be a journalist from a very young age, from like primary school. I'm not entirely sure why, but I did, and I wanted to be a football journalist because getting into the games for nothing and being paid to watch football just seemed like the greatest ever job. So I went and studied at Napier University in Edinburgh, did journalism, then did the traditional kind of local paper route, mm-hmm. for a couple of local papers. Then
what local papers were you on?
The Berwickshire News was my first one, which is just still on the Scottish side of the border,
right.
before you get to Berwick. Then the Falkirk Herald for 4 years. And then I moved to...
What type of things were you writing about? Just everything?
As a general news reporter,
yeah.
court, district council, you know, car crashes, crime, local crime, council decisions, all that type of stuff. It's a great grounding as
yeah.
a journalist. I would recommend it. But the local papers, seeing regional papers, are kind of dying on their backsides now, sadly. But so that was my kind of... That's where I cut my teeth. And then I moved to an agency, a press mm-hmm. agency, selling stories to the Nationals. Then I worked for the Press Association, which was which is the national news agency.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that's when I got into
yep.
politics, because I covered Holyrood for them.
Yep.
So I did that for 3 years, thoroughly enjoyed it, and then moved to the Scotsman
mm-hmm.
to do education. But always wanted to go back to doing politics. Then moved to the Herald to do politics, again at Holyrood, and then got the chance to come down here with the Daily Record. Got tapped up and came down here in 2008 and been here ever since. And yeah, it's a privilege really to work at Westminster, I would say. You know, you get to see a lot of drama, meet a lot of interesting people, and you've got a bit of a front row seat really for a lot of the big occasions.
And obviously there's a lot of difference between Holyrood and Westminster.
Yeah.
What was the biggest, I mean, one of the things being the economy of London is just so different, so everything about it is different,
aye.
But what was the biggest change? Did you find it difficult to adapt to reporting in Westminster if you haven't been up at Holyrood, or did you smoothly get into it? Was there some big story that you managed to get involved in that helped, or what?
Well, the first day I came here was Michael Martin, if you remember, was still the Speaker.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And it was right
oh,
at
I
the
remember.
Time, he
yeah.
was having a hell of a time,
uh-huh.
and he just wasn't very good, to be perfectly blunt, and he was in some, it was some scandal about, I think it was his wife,
mm-hmm.
taxi receipts or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, that's right.
So, that was a big story for the Record, because Glasgow MP, and so it's kind of got stuck into that, and Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister at the time, obviously, which helped.
Yeah.
So, Labour paper, Labour Prime Minister, Scottish Labour Prime Minister, so, you know, got to interview him a couple of times, which was good, because obviously he wanted to speak to the Daily Record.
Yeah.
And at that time, there's a lot of Labour MPs, so a lot has changed since then. And so they all wanted their names in the Daily Record as well, you know. And
Would you ever have to go back up to Glasgow to the Record's offices, or were you just permanently based?
Mainly, well, I was permanently based here, but you'd have to go up every now and again.
So would you be travelling with them at any time to build relationships and stuff?
Yeah, I went to Washington with Gordon Brown not long after I started, a couple of months after I started. I did a trip to Washington, New York, Washington and Boston, which was good.
Mm-hmm.
Got into the White House, which was an amazing experience. George Bush was the president at the time. They had a press conference in the Rose Garden
right.
outside, so that was quite cool.
What's it like?
It's just astonishing, really. You have to pinch yourself that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever watched The West Wing.
Yeah,
like the West Wing. Well, the press room where you see the CJ Craig do the press briefings is exactly the same. So it's a bit smaller in real life. So we got to sit in there, which was quite cool. We were all like dead excited about that. And then we got to go outside, as I say, into the Rose Garden.
Yeah.
And you can see the Oval Office, like where Brown and Bush came out of the Oval Office. You could kind of see through the window. So that was great. That was a magic experience. And then went to Boston to the JFK Library. Brown was doing a speech there. So that was brilliant, actually. That was one of the best trips that I've ever been on. And then since then, moved to the Sun a couple of years later. Went on loads of trips.
Yep.
With David Cameron.
Because that was National, wasn't it?
Aye. Yeah.
Sorry, the National Sun as opposed to the Daily Record, which is
Scottish
the in-house paper of the Labour Party.
Well, quite. Aye. Yeah. Which, you know, might explain why their readership's gone down quite a bit of late, unfortunately. But yeah, so I mean, it's a great place to work, and it's an interesting time with elections coming up, referendum, all that type of stuff.
Working in here and working so closely with them, does that change your opinion of either parties or individual MPs? It surely must do.
Yeah, well, you see them as human beings. You see them actually what they're like, and you know, the politicians, rightly, I suppose, in a lot of cases get a bad reputation. People think they're liars and scheming, and there's an element of that, there's no doubt, but at the same time they are kind of normal human beings, and there's a fair few Celtic fans as well, actually. So you can kind of bond over that, you know. One of them actually was Jim Devine, if you remember. Yes. Jim, who when he was a Labour MP obviously ended badly for Jim, but he was a really good contact. And he even when my first daughter was born, this was obviously before all the scandal broke around Jim, he said to me, "Oh, what's your address?" And I told him. He goes, "Oh, I've got me a present for you, for your daughter." And I was like, "Oh, that's very nice of you, Jim." A couple of days later, comes through the post, he bought a brick at Parkhead for her. So her name is up there, Charlotte Schofield, is at Parkhead, and that was thanks to Jim Devine, bizarrely, you know. So,
but did you declare it?
I probably shouldn't say. No. Fortunately, those rules don't cover journalists, so I'm safe there.
So there must be times when you built a relationship with people. I suppose it's a bit like a football journalist, you know, because that's who we mainly speak to.
Yeah.
Where you've got to be nice to someone, but at the same time you've got to stick the boot into them.
Well, aye, and but then.
Or there must be times when there's somebody that you don't think personally deserves the kicking, but actually what they've done, you're going to have to give them it.
Oh, you've got to be professional, you know, and you put your sort of personal feelings to one side, you know, and if they deserve a going over, then you've got to give them a going over. You know, you can't ignore a story. But they know the game as well, you know. It's they'll maybe give you things, little bits of gossip or wee stories of that, which is great for you, get it on the website. But at the same time, and it's good for them because you know, because they're pursuing their own particular agenda as well. But you know, if they get into trouble, then you can't turn a blind eye. You've just got to publish and be damned.
So after you were at the Sun, you've then gone to Politics Home, which, well, do you want to talk about how that happened and what it is? And
aye, well, I've been at the Sun for 5.5 years. I've done a couple of elections with them, general elections, and I just felt it was time for a change. You could kind of see the way newspaper circulations are going. They're only going one way, sadly. And online is the future. Really, most people read their news now online on their phones rather than in a newspaper. And the opportunity came to take charge of the website, which had been going for a wee while, and I went for the job and got it, fortunately. And I only started last August, so that's been sort of coming up for 9 months. And it's good fun. It's good to have the freedom. You need to write a story, get it up on a website, and get it out there, get it tweeted. You get a bit of reaction from.
You're certainly doing a good job of raising the profile of the website, because anybody who's got a semblance of interest in politics or news will have seen you on newspaper reviews on the telly.
Aye.
We'll have heard you on various radio programmes.
Yeah.
So you're certainly giving the website profile.
Well, that was part of the job, was to try and raise the profile a bit and break a few more stories. And yeah, they did say, look, if you get opportunities to go on TV or radio, go for it. You know, as long as they say you're from Politics Home, then that's fine by us. So no, it's good. I enjoy it, and it just gives you the extra string to your bow, you know, for the future.
So there's some big political stories coming up.
Yeah.
I do find the European referendum peculiar, but I'll get into that in a minute, because first of all, Holyrood. What do you think's going to happen?
It seems pretty obvious. I mean, I'm 400 miles away now and haven't been in Scotland for 8 years, but you've only got to look at the opinion polls to see that the SNP are going to win. Yeah. I don't know, it's up for debate, and they're probably going to win another overall majority, probably bigger than the one they've got. And it's going to be the only interest, I guess, in the night is whether Labour finish second or third. If they finish third, that's an incredible story. You know, the Tories overtaking them. I never thought you would ever see the day. I mean, speaking to one or two Labour people, they think that their support is being slightly underplayed in the polls.
Didn't the Lib Dems about a year ago say the same thing?
Well, that's true. That is true.
But our core constituents will always vote Lib Dem because they're Lib Dem to the core, and we've got powerful individuals whose names will carry sway.
Aye, and they were good local campaigners, so people will vote for the local candidate. So they remember a wee bit of that. But I mean, so Labour think they're going to finish second, but it just seems a case of how much are the SNP going to win by. And that is just kind of where Scottish politics is right now, you know. But it's interesting that the SNP haven't put a firm commitment to another referendum in their manifesto, you know, so it gives them a bit of wriggle room. So it's fascinating to see how they, because they've got to please their core membership, who all want independence tomorrow, while also not wanting to scare folk who think they're doing a good job at running the Scottish Government but don't really support independence. And so far it would appear that they're doing that reasonably well.
I like to see myself as apolitical. As an apolitical person, it looks like their strategy is just don't do anything rock. Parking people listening to this thinking about the Offensive Behaviour Act. And,
But
it does seem to be their strategy just seems to be just be bland.
Aye. Well, that's it.
Can just be bland, we'll stay in power for a long time.
Well, they've got everything to lose, so why bother taking any risks? You know, they don't want to put up the top rate tax, the 50p, even though they said last year that they did. And that's just because they don't want to lose votes from the well off.
Strangely enough, taxes, putting up taxes loses votes.
Well, funny that, you know.
Because we all say one thing, but actually behave differently.
Well, I've seen there was a poll that said that Scots, like something like 70% support the policy of raising the top rate to 50p. But that's more people support are in favour of other people paying more tax, because most folk in Scotland, it won't affect them.
One of the things I remember finding a stat that something like the top 10% of earners in the UK earn $32,000.
And
the top 5% earn like $50,000 or something like that. I love asking people that question, because they invariably tell you that the top 5% are somewhere in the region of $200,000 upwards.
That's right,
and the top 10% are $100,000 upwards. So it's them that should be taxed.
Totally.
So you should tax the top 10%. Aye, so that's you then, mate. No.
Well, that's it. And that's the thing. We're told that Scots are more egalitarian and they're more willing to pay higher taxes for better public services and to help the less well off. But polling evidence would seem to suggest that's not
the public are two-faced.
Exactly. They tell people there's one thing. You know, the SNP have been very, very popular, and part of that is because, you know, free prescriptions, froze the council tax, free tuition for kids whose parents could well afford to pay tuition fees. So you can see why they've sort of hoovered up votes from your well-off, really, you know.
So
people who actually do go out and vote.
The other big political thing, which I think because the last referendum was so active in Scotland that you couldn't literally, the dogs in the street were talking about who they were going to vote for.
Yeah.
The European referendum for me seems to be a Conservative Party debate that's happening in the southeast of England. The national news play out as a main story. That's what it feels like.
I mean, it's not like, I suppose it's different being Scottish, but the Scottish referendum, it felt personal. You know, I felt like you had a real vested interest in it. And this is a big deal as well. You know, if we were to come out of the EU, I think it would be, you know, it'd be a massive change for folk in the long run. But yeah, at the moment, the whole debate is seen through the prism of the Tory party ripping themselves apart. But that ignores the fact that it'll be Labour voters who actually decide what the outcome is, you know, because the Tories are going to be split. So you're not going to get a victory on the back of the Tories. It's what the Labour voters do.
And is it just because the Tories have got such high-profile personalities on either side that it looks that the media aren't really covering it as anything other than a Boris Johnson saying this and George Osborne saying that debate?
Yeah.
Because from my perspective, it sounds like, it almost feels like you feel like phoning up and saying, Are Labour involved in this or not? Is it just an internal Tory thing?
Well, yeah, it is basically at the moment. They're the ones that have all the kind of hype, as you see, the high profile figures, and we like nothing more than a split story.
Yep.
As journalists, and you know, you've got Tory cabinet ministers at each other's throats. People who, like Gove and Cameron, are very, very close,
yep,
but are on complete opposite sides of the debate and are, again, as I say, at each other's throats on this one, you know. And I think this notion that they'll get the referendum out of the way and the Tory party will just come back together seamlessly and move on as if nothing's happened is far-fetched, you know. I think it's going to be a lot of bad blood, especially if it's a Leave vote, you know. Well, Cameron will lose his job.
Osborne will lose his job, I suppose
by dint of Cameron losing his job, probably Osborne will lose his job and he'll give up any chance of succeeding, yep, Cameron. That's what's probably going to happen. That's what everyone seems to think. So we'll see how it goes. So we could be sitting here in a couple months' time with, you know, a new Prime Minister almost.
And people are often talking about the Labour Party could eventually split into two parties.
Yeah.
Although it did that like 30 years ago.
It tried that before. Yeah. Yeah.
If there was a Leave, could the Tories do that?
I don't think so. No, yeah, they wouldn't. No. But it'll be interesting to see what happens to UKIP as well, whether UKIP will benefit from that kind of SNP post-referendum bounce, if you see what I mean. You know, we've got a lot of folk, kind of buyer's remorse if we vote to stay in. A lot of folk, a lot of Tories might just decamp to UKIP and carry on the fight that way, you know. So I kind of see the Tories physically splitting, but I think you might get
people going
to UKIP.
What would happen to the Labour if we vote Leave? I ask that because people are only talking from through the prism of,
yeah,
what will happen to the Tory party. Cameron would have to go and blah, blah, blah.
Well, I think there is a school of thought, I think, unofficially, amongst a lot of Labour people that, well, Leave vote is probably going to be the end of Cameron. So that's an opportunity for them, you know. Prime Minister comes down. I mean, Labour are a pro-Europe party, yeah, by and large. I mean, I don't think there'll be a massive impact on them straight away, but they would have to kind of recalibrate. And
I'm just wondering if there might be somebody perceiving that there's a middle ground to try and win.
Well, yeah.
If it's perceived that the Tories have now jumped to the right.
Yeah, but then you would need to have a leader who... Labour need to have a leader who wants to occupy that centre ground, and I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is really interested in the middle ground. He's more interested in the left of the political spectrum, I think. So that's all elections, as we know, are won from the centre.
Yeah.
History tells us that. The SNP are a centrist party, and they've been very successful. That's how New Labour were successful. That's where the Tories are successful at the moment. So I think as long as Jeremy Corbyn is the leader of the Labour Party, you're not going to see them trying to... There'll be those within the party who think they should.
Mm-hmm.
It all comes from the top.
You wouldn't see one of those ex-playwrights leaping to, let's have a quick bloodbath while the Tories are in a bigger bloodbath than us and see if we can get it over and done with while everybody's looking at them since they're in power.
There's certainly open talk. There's no doubt about that. There is open talk here amongst a lot of Labour MPs that wait till the referendum's out the way and then go for Jeremy. I'm not giving away any secrets here, people know that.
Old boy will be on your case. Stirring this up.
But they still have the problem that there isn't an obvious candidate and there isn't an obvious mechanism for getting rid of him, you know. And if they were to get rid of, well, if they were to challenge him and he got back on the ballot paper for the rerun of the leadership,
yep,
he would win. There's no doubt about it. So So yeah, I wouldn't write off Jeremy Corbyn's chances of being Prime Minister at the next election just yet.
So what's the general mood in here of what's going to happen in June for that vote?
Well, I think the received wisdom is that we will vote to remain, and it'll be a narrow vote to remain. That's what people think. But at the same time, you speak to a lot of MPs and they'll tell you it's on a knife edge, you know. You speak to a lot of Labour MPs. Obviously the official Labour Party position is support staying in, but a lot of Labour MPs from traditional Labour seats say that their constituents want to come out, and it's mainly because of migration. That is the big issue for them, and they want to leave the EU because they think that will help Britain sort of regain control of the borders, cut down on immigration. Whether it will or not is open to debate, I think, but that's what they believe.
Well, if that's perception becomes reality.
Totally. And you know, so yeah, as I say, the feeling, I think if you were to take a poll within here, most people would say it'd probably be narrow Remain, but it could easily go that way.
If it's really, really close, I mean, obviously in Scotland, we're experiencing, the initial thing was, well, there was a 10% gap. That's only a 5% swing, and considering that most of our lives it's been under 30% in favour of independence, to get up to 45.
Yeah.
If it's 48-52, are we going to go through all this again? And
well, who knows? Because I think you would then probably get a lot of Leave people would say that they were robbed. You know, that the government sort of, it wasn't a fair fight, it wasn't a level playing field, because they spent all that money on the leaflets being sent to everybody's house and all that type of stuff. So I think it would rumble on for quite some time.
And I think that's also the other reason why I feel less impassioned about this referendum. Because everything that's getting, the people that are watching the news, people getting their knickers in a twist about, swap out Europe and put in the Scottish referendum. It's exactly the same points that we went through.
I know. It is like Groundhog Day.
It is Groundhog Day for us.
The arguments are still, a lot of them the same about,
you know, the sun will fall out of the sky if we leave or if we stay and all that sort of stuff.
Totally. And it's like people, I think, are just bamboozled by, no one knows. That's the thing. It is a genuine, it's, you've got to kind of weigh up the options and decide what you think you're more likely to believe. I mean, there won't be the same turnout as well that there was in Scotland. You know, there's no chance we're going to get 85% or anything like that, anything near it. But no, a lot of the arguments are exactly the same. For Scottish
and might that be the tipping point of the people who are most agitated by the whole European debate, and the people who are most who have the greatest motivation to go out and vote are the people who don't like Europe?
Well, that's it. If the 23rd of June is a horrible, stinking wet day, who's more likely to get and vote? It's going to be the folk who want to leave, because this is their one chance to achieve their political ambition. So they're going to get out there. Whereas you've got to think your Remain people are probably going to be like, ugh, does it really matter? We're going to win anyway. I'm no bother. And that again could tip it in favour of Brexit. So I wouldn't like to sort of put the mortgage on either way at the moment.
So, a bit like I've also, I remember asking Richard Gordon this point from a football perspective, and it's the same. We all have views and opinions. How do you keep your impartiality?
Well, I mentioned before I work for the Press Association, and they are like dead straight down the line, and Politics Home is dead straight down the line, and you've just got to be a professional, really. I mean, it's just, it's like, as you say, like the football guys, you know, we might all think, oh, Keith Jackson, he's a Rangers man, or, you know, Graham Spears, well, he admits he was a Rangers man. I'm not entirely sure what he has now, but, you know, I think by and large journalists, and I'm bound to say this, I suppose, are pretty good at hiding their true feelings, you know, just reporting the facts. I mean, that was part of the reason why I wanted to move to Politics Home, because it's dead straight down the line. You know, I worked for The Sun, so obviously that's right-leaning paper.
Yep.
Worked for The Record, which is left-leaning paper. So I've kind of done both. And I'm obviously not left and right, so I have my own personal opinions, and I just fancied kind of writing straight down the line. It's actually, it's quite easy. If it's a story, it's a story. It doesn't matter if it's making Labour look bad, or the Tories, or the SNP, or the Lib Dem, whoever. You just write the story. You know? That's what gets you more excited. Your own political opinions don't really come into it, to be honest with you. If it's a good story, it's a good story.
Now, we are sitting here today, and there's a telly above my head, and the news has just come on at 6 o'clock. How do you think the politicians are going to deal with everything that should or could come out of this Hillsborough inquest outcome?
Well, we're going to get a statement from my Home Secretary tomorrow, so we'll wait and see what she says. But I think it looks like there'll probably be some kind of criminal cases on the back of the verdict today. Obviously, this is a legacy back to the Thatcher years, and there was obviously a lot of collusion between the police and the government of the day to try and create a narrative that was the fans were to blame, and that's been completely blown apart today. But I mean, Labour set this in train by releasing the Hillsborough documents, but it took them about 10, 12 years of being in government.
Jack Straw, not initially. I think Jack Straw rejected initial moves when he was Home Secretary.
And it wasn't until Andy Burnham, there was one of the Hillsborough memorials,
it's the 20th anniversary.
That's what it was. And he got booed at Anfield. Yeah. And that was quite a I shook him up basically, and he then said, right, we're going to listen. So, but that, as I say, that was 12 years it took Labour to do. So Labour don't really come out of this smelling the roses either. You know, they could have done that in 1997 when they got elected, but they didn't for whatever reason. So the political fallout now is probably going to be less important, I think, than the criminal repercussions, because now that it's officially out there, they were unlawfully killed
by the, and the police were at fault,
then the natural sort of conclusion of that is, right, well, we've got to have people who must be held criminally responsible for it.
And one of the things about that is the big thing is it's South Yorkshire Police. Mm. And South Yorkshire Police were the police force that were biggest had one of the biggest issues in the miners' strike.
Oh, yeah.
And there's big demands for an inquiry into what happened at Orgreave.
Okay.
Do you think this will push the politicians, or do you think that would have only pushed a Labour government and the Tory government will stand firm?
Well, certainly Andy Burnham is pushing for that, and Labour are pushing for that. There seems to be more public inquiry. The government seems to be more receptive these days to public inquiries. Whether or not there'll be one for Orgreave, I think you're probably right. It's the type of thing that a Labour government would probably set up. I think it's unlikely that the Tories are going to do it.
What have they got to gain?
Well, that's right.
It's not going to win them votes.
It's not going to win them votes, and it's going to dredge up a lot of...
And it just make them look bad,
exactly.
Because there'll no doubt be further, even more political collusion with the police.
Totally, and that just reflects very badly on them.
Allegedly.
Yes, allegedly.
Okay, so that's your politics. Back onto the football, and back onto Celtic.
Oh, really? Okay, then.
What you?
I were marching to the title gloriously.
Did you manage to see any of the game on Sunday?
So I caught a bit of it. Well, I caught most of the second half. So it was. You could kind of see it coming. I mean, home games at the moment are just a trial, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's no atmosphere in the ground. Stadium's half empty, and the team isn't doing anything to change that. You know, the team isn't doing anything to get fans turning up, or when they do turn up, actually off their seats and excited, you know. And it's just like, it's almost like now they just want to get the season over and done.
I got the impression on Sunday it was the manager's going, we've won the league. Can we just all go home and then set up for the new guy?
Well, I mean,
which we haven't won the league. That was the frustrating thing.
Yeah, no, quite. But I mean, the player of the year dance on Sunday night must have been the worst do you've ever been in your life.
It'd have been just as well standing up and saying, "Now, player of the year." So everybody else can go home apart from Lee Griffiths.
Yeah, quite exactly. I mean, I dread to think where we'd be this season without him. I mean, we probably wouldn't have won the league without his goals. In fact, I'm sure we wouldn't have won the league without his goals.
No, no, no. Although, to be fair, I mean, that's the reason why we are. I was saying to someone, and I don't know if we can quite do it now. I need to work out the points. No, we can't quite do it. Oh, we could do it. I wouldn't put it past us the way this season has gone. I think if we draw with Hearts on Saturday at lunchtime, we are 10 points clear.
Yeah.
With Aberdeen having potential 12 points to win.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it past us the way this season has gone for Aberdeen to lose, so we win the league by default, without doing anything.
I think it'd be quite fitting, really, because it's... I can't imagine there's been any league title has been probably going to be celebrated as mutedly as this one, you know. And when you think back to when we stopped 10 in a row, I mean, that still is probably just about the best day in my life as a Celtic fan, actually being there. That was just fantastic. And you compare that, I suppose we actually hadn't won the league in such a long 10 years.
Yeah.
You would never think that winning the league would become a chore or be boring, but it has become like that, certainly this season more than any. It's just murder.
Yeah. And certainly I think since we lost the midweek game at Aberdeen,
yeah,
that was the day that I think the majority of supporters knew that no matter what, we were changing the manager in the summer.
Yeah.
So it then became a point of, can we just get this season done and dusted so we can get to the point of choosing a new manager?
Not quite, yeah.
And that then becomes a real trudge.
Oh, totally. And obviously, well, then the only other thing you had was the cup in the semi-final, and we know how that went. So that was just an added factor in the boredom.
So I'll ask you, I'll ask somebody else. First of all, you don't need to give me a name. You might just want to describe the type of person. Who would you like as the next Celtic manager?
Well, I will give you a name. I think Moyes should be the next Celtic manager. I think he's the best candidate that's been named. And I know there's good reasons against him, in that you look at his record and you think, well, he's never really done it in Europe. He's never really won anything,
yep,
which is true. But I think he did a decent job at Everton, a really, really good job at Everton. Obviously, he was deemed good enough by Alex Ferguson to be Man United manager. Didn't work out for him. Although, in hindsight, actually, the job he did was no worse than Louis van Gaal's done, with an awful lot more money. And it took him to the quarterfinals of the Champions League.
Yeah,
as well.
I just think he just must permanently look at it and think, what I could have done with an extra £200 million to spend.
Aye, well, quite. And I think he has the stature. I think he would command respect of the players, which I think Ronnie has always struggled to do. It'd be interesting to see if he'd bring Chris Woods as his goalkeeping coach. That would be one to keep an eye out for. But yeah, I think Moyes.
Well, Stevie Woods listens to this podcast, so hopefully not.
I'm sure his job's safe. I think he would be my choice. I think we need to send out a message, because Rangers are coming back with a.
It's an odd Freudian slip to mix up Rangers.
I've never done that in my life, I don't think. they're coming back with their tails up, the usual, think that you're going to lord it over everyone. We know that's not the case, but we do need to put down a marker and say, right, semi-final is one thing, but we're still the top dogs, so this is how we're going to prove it. Get a big manager in, give him some serious money to spend, and give him his head and let him got on with it and change the recruitment strategy, because the recruitment strategy is just a joke.
I just did the podcast with Steve McGowan, and Steve McGowan had been on Radio Scotland making the point of Celtic's issue has been they were out shopping at 800 grand, 600 grand, 800 grand, £1 million, 1.2 in a mid-table Dutch or Belgian team.
Mm-hmm.
Getting that player in for 2 years and selling on for 13.
Yeah.
And Celtic's problem is these clubs have got wise to it and thought, well, if Celtic are coming in for this guy, he's got the potential to be a £13 million player. So Celtic, the price is £4 million.
Oh, totally. Aye, absolutely.
But equally, then that just means looking further afield and looking and trying to find new places to look for that type of player.
Well, we've just got to. I mean, we hit a rich seam, obviously, with Wanyama, Hooper, Van Dijk was the last one, really.
Yep.
That's 3 or 4 years we've gone now.
Mm-hmm.
So, there has to be a serious rethink of the recruitment. I mean, I don't know, is it still John Park that's in charge of that?
Yeah.
Well, for whatever, it's all falling to bits. I mean, Colin, Kazim Richards, Carlton Cole. I mean, nobody's ever going to be able to explain that one to me.
It's the point I keep getting at. We sent Skepovic out on loan because he didn't fit, and we brought in Chief G, Cole and Kazim Richards.
Yeah.
Which one, from the brief bits I saw of Skepovic, I'd like to know which one of those three is better than him.
Well,
I'm not saying Skepovic is a world beater.
No, he's not, definitely not. But he didn't appear to be any worse than him. I mean, Carlton Cole he couldn't get a club. He's never fit. What the hell are you doing?
I've said to people before, I can understand the principle of Carlton Cole if you are focusing on young players.
Yeah.
And Carlton Cole's got a fantastic attitude. He's very mature and he doesn't cost very much. They're almost just wanting to have a bridge between the management and those young players in the dressing room all the time. That concept of bringing in a reasonably experienced guy who he's on their side of the fence, so they take stuff on from him. I can understand that principle. But that would then involve our whole squad being young players who are learning from him, and him, and all you hear at Celtic Park is Carlton Cole's a fantastic trainer and a fantastic role model, and
hearing that. And also, we don't, I mean, that was the other thing. Ronnie was brought in as a developer, somebody who'd bring through young players and mould teams around about them. And he's, what's the Scott Allen thing? What's all that? I don't understand. Scott Allen and Ryan Christie, I just don't understand that. They bring these boys in and clearly the manager, it wasn't the manager's choice, or else he'd have given them a few games.
He said they were his choice.
Why is he not playing them? He doesn't seem to give them any chances at all.
The point I often make to people is, so Kevin, you've got the option of signing Danny Wilson, Dedrick Boyata, or Harry Brady. Who are you going to sign? Well, you signed Dedrick Boyata, so yeah, it was your choice. But was it really your choice? Because actually your two other options were not really options.
Yeah. Well, you're given a substance choice, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, no choice, somebody close to Neil Lennon once told me that when Pukki came in, Neil Lennon was given the option of, you've got two options, Timo Pukki or Mr. Nobody.
Yeah, it's not much of a choice, is it?
Yeah, so technically the manager chose.
Aye.
He could have chose to have nobody.
Yeah. Aye. So there's, but then the manager has to be able to rely on the...
So you're a Moyes man, which would change a lot about the culture of the club as well, because I can't see Moyes doing anything other than saying, I am 100% hands-on, in control. The scouts are only to provide me with information and then I'll make the choice.
Aye, which is maybe a bit of an old-fashioned view now, but the current strategy clearly isn't working. It did work for a while, and it improved the balance sheet, and it bore fruit on occasion, but now I think it's a busted
position. Playing in the Champions League would improve our balance sheet.
Well, that's true. Well, yeah, but to do that, you've got to invest.
Correct.
And the Champions League.
Yes, and I am very much, I understand the dilemma of a lot of supporters say speculate to accumulate.
Well, you can no
guarantee that speculate will accumulate.
Absolutely. So I know, I get that, and the club doesn't want to go into lots of debt, and I completely understand that. But I think there's a balance to be struck. And
we've gone the wrong side of that.
Jesus. Yeah. I mean, there's downsizing, and it's just the club is just diminished.
Yeah. So you've got we've got Hearts coming up on Saturday.
Yeah. If we win, it's an easy game, I think.
We are champions.
Yeah.
What's your prediction?
Oh, Jesus. I mean, that's the thing. You're never confident going into any games now. You know, I'd like to think we'll go there and, you know, put on a show. You're always optimistic.
Yep.
A minute before kickoff, and then 5 minutes after kickoff, usually you're a bit deflated.
Lee Griffiths will be desperate to score.
He's got a good record against Hearts. He loves.
Although
playing at times.
At times, I think it's the last game of Celtic Park. I thought he was trying too hard.
Aye. Well, there is a bit of that. I mean, the game against Hearts, actually Celtic played pretty well at Parkhead that day. I'll stick my neck out and say we'll win. I mean, we kind of keep being rubbish, you know, and maybe just the fact that it's at Tynecastle helps. I just don't think
smaller
playing
pitch,
at home,
atmosphere.
It, amazing atmosphere. I don't think playing at home is doing us any favours at the moment, because the atmosphere is awful, and I think that sort of translates itself onto the pitch. So, aye, I mean, if they can't lift their game with the league title at stake, a great atmosphere, then they may as well just chuck it.
Well, they didn't do that on Sunday.
No, that's true.
So, what's the score going to be?
I'm going to say 2-1.
2-1. Who's going to score?
Well, it's hard to see past Griffiths, really. I mean, he's pretty much our only source of goals at the moment. I mean, Rogic, I suppose, chips in every now and again as well. Griffiths, too. He'll score both goals.
He'll score both goals?
That's what I think.
Okay. And what's the team going to be?
Well, what's the team going to be, or the team I would pick? I
mean, give me both.
Oh, God, right. Well, I mean, Gordon, obviously, he picks himself. Tierney picks himself. Lustig, I think, is a shoo-in. At the back, it'll probably be Mulgrew and
Svechenko,
I think. I quite like Mulgrew at centre-half, actually. I would never have him anywhere near the midfield. I'm not a Brown fan these days. I think Brown's gone right off the boil, but at the same time, who else are you going to play? So probably, assuming it's going to be 4-2-3, it's going to be Brown and Gibbton again. I really like Patrick Roberts. I think he's a really exciting wee player. I'd have Rogic in the number 10 role behind Griffiths, and on the left, Christ.
I thought Colin Kazim-Richard played well on Sunday.
That's all right.
He was industrious, he worked hard, he gave us a diagonal out ball. I couldn't help but thinking he's a poor man's George Samaras.
Yeah. Well, that was a great position for Sammy, you know, coming in off the left, and he was good at it. I mean, Stuart Armstrong, we've kind of ruined Stuart Armstrong. That's somebody else. He's ruined him playing him in that position. I don't understand why he couldn't have found a role in the middle for him, but he just has never really tried it. So anyway, so
that's
Mackay Stephen.
Right, okay.
But I mean, it's not a great
So
option.
What would your team be, not trying to second guess the manager? Would you play 4-4-2, 4-3-3, 3-5-2?
Yeah, the 4-4-2. But then, well, you think, I mean, instinctively, being old-fashioned, I guess I would probably say I-4-4-2. But then, do we have the squad to even play
well,
that?
I don't know who the two strikers would be.
Well, you'd have Griffiths and presumably Kaz and Richards. Because I can't think of anybody else. Is Cole still injured? Or is he just no quoted?
I read somewhere something about some family issue he was dealing with, so
right.
I don't know.
So he's like not right. Well, probably
you could play Commons and Griffiths. I mean, Lennon sort of did that.
Well, we've not done that probably since Lennon played him just off.
Yeah.
Probably back four, I think, pretty much picks itself, and five if you include Gordon. I would probably have Brown in there. I mean, I'd like to say have Scott Allen in there, but it's been such a long time since we've seen the guy. We don't even know if he can tie shoelaces anymore, you know. So I quite like Bitton. I mean, I think he's a good player, Bitton. So Brown and Bitton. I'm playing 4-4-2. I'm picking the same team.
But you're picking the same team because you're not seeing.
Well, there's not a lot of options.
Well, I mean, you could do the random fan thing of, well, they must be better than what's there, and pick Christie and Allen.
But
Forrest and.
Yeah, I wouldn't pick Forrest. I think he kind of flatters to deceive. So we are where we are. There's not a great deal of options. That's probably part of the problem. Rogic, I'd have Rogic in there actually. Maybe Brown and Rogic.
No,
I'm. I've just dropped Bitton. Sorry, Nia.
He's been anonymous last two games.
Aye. So what? Brown and Rogic in the middle. Patrick Roberts on the right, coming in off on his left foot. Yeah, Kaz and Richards Griffiths up front, and who do you have on the left? Commons maybe. I like Chris Commons. But maybe I'm thinking of Chris Commons for a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I probably am. Anyway, so that would be my team, which is scarily similar to Ronnie Dyler. Get off Ronnie Dyler's back. He's doing a great job.
And do you think Ronnie Dyler will ever? I think one day we'll be watching Ronnie Dyler managing some other team in European football.
Guaranteed.
I mean, say, a bit like.
And they'll knock us out at the Champions League qualifiers.
Harold Brattbach's going for Rosenborg when they beat us.
How many times? Or that, what was his name? What was it last year? Or this season?
Joe Berger.
Aye. He came back and scored, and they never looked like a player for Celtic and comes back and scores against us. So, aye, you can kind of see
some
it.
Some people are just suited to. You know, there must be MPs who. They were just as a cabinet minister, they were just never suited to that particular job, but actually they're a good minister in another job.
Or they can be good MPs and they're just no cut out to run a department. I just think it's written in the stars, because I can see Ronnie Dyer ending up back in Norway, and it'll be a Norwegian club that we end up playing in the Champions qualifiers, and it'll just all be about Ronnie Dyer coming back to get his revenge, and it'll go horribly wrong. But that's because you're naturally pessimistic these days as a Celtic fan, probably.
Yes.
The thing is, as well, you mentioned it in the last podcast.
And then people will go on and say, see, he's never got Moyes in because he never can win it in.
That's right. Was that Schofield? He knows nothing. But listen, I wish Ronnie all the best. I said at the last podcast, nobody comes into Celtic and you want them to fail.
Yeah.
It's just a shame it's no worked out, and I guess I wish him all the best for the future.
Okay, well, with that I will say let the band play on, Kevin, and thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast with Kevin. We, as I said earlier, we hopefully will have won the title if you're listening to this after 2 o'clock on Saturday. But hey, who knows? Whatever it is, I'm sure there was a grand old show in the Glasgow Celtic were there. Anyway, enough of me. With him, Kevin Schofield, we have the Celtic FC Foundation dinner for the Heartbreakers on Sunday night taking place. So if you're listening to this, there might still be a chance to squeeze yourself in to one or two of the tickets that are left. There is also the Celtic FC Foundation pilgrimage walk. And then on the day when we lift the trophy, the last game of the season at home to Motherwell on, pretty certain it's the 15th of May, we will have the bucket collection for Celtic FC Foundation. As I say, that was Kevin Schofield of Politics Home. As part of my university dissertation, which was taking place only 5 years after Hillsborough, to bore you, my title was The Delictual Liability of Sports Clubs to Members and Spectators, if I can get that right. But anyway, I read quite a lot of the witness testimony on Hillsborough, and absolutely harrowing that it was. So there was a wee bit of a tear in my eye. I was listening to the radio as the court gave its verdict. I'm sure there was for you too. Anyway, this is the end of the Celtic Underground podcast for today. Hope you enjoyed it. There'll be more along soon, and just a wee bit of a tribute to the 96 coming up.
Well, I think the biggest irony is that the sun is shining now and Hillsborough's quiet, and over there to the left, the green Yorkshire hills. And who would have known that people would die here in the stadium this afternoon? I don't necessarily want to reflect on Heysel, but I was there that night broadcasting with Emlyn Hughes, and he was sitting behind me this afternoon. And after half an hour of watching stretchers going out and oxygen cylinders being brought in and ambulance sirens screaming, he touched me on the shoulder and he said, "I can't take any more." And Emlyn Hughes left. The gymnasium here at Hillsborough is being used as a mortuary for the dead. And at this moment, stewards have got cartons and little paper bags, and they're gathering up the personal belongings of the spectators, some of whom died, some of whom are now seriously injured in nearby hospitals. And there are red and white scarves of Liverpool, and red and white bobble hats of Liverpool, and red and white rosettes of Liverpool, and nothing else out there on the enclosure where all the deaths occurred. And the sun shines now.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. The end of a storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver.